As JT said, my name is Jacob Miller. For anybody that doesn't know me, I'm one of the pastors here at Freshwater, and occasionally I speak. And so it's a tremendous privilege to get to do that, one I take very seriously, and I put a lot of work in this. We have about, I'm going to apologize if you get any glare off the head when I bend down and grab my water. We have about 19 verses to get through. And if you don't know me, I'm a very logical, like, hit it kind of guy. Like, so I have to go through all 19 verses. So we're going to get to cooking here, okay? So glad that you're here, and glad that you're joining us in our journey through Mark. We are going through Mark verse by verse. We are in chapter 14. We started this almost a year ago. We're coming up on a year here pretty quick. We're at chapter 14 right now. We're going to be in 14, 53 through 72 is what we're going to be in. Mark 14, 53 through 72, if you want to turn there. I'll give you just a couple seconds here. And now the context leading up to this, if you weren't here last week, JT preached for us, and we were in the Garden of Gethsemane. We were actually there for the last 2 weeks. But last week, we entered into this concept of betrayal. Judas betrayed Jesus. Judas was one of Jesus' disciples, which means he was one of his closest friends. And he had traveled with him for the better part of 3 years as Jesus had ministered. Should I move up or what? Back? Okay. See, I'm clueless. I'm sorry. Clueless. So Jesus had been betrayed by Judas, and we talked about that last week. So what we're going to do here is we're going to travel out of the Garden of Gethsemane, and we're going to move on to this next chapter of betrayal in Jesus' life, which is Jesus before the religious authorities of Israel. And so also in line with that, we kind of simultaneously, while Jesus is being tried before the Jewish religious leaders of Israel, one of his closest friends, even out of the disciples, also betrays him, basically at the same time. So he has a very personal and intimate betrayal, probably more so than Judas even before that happened. And these are the two stories, basically narratives, historical narratives, that Mark is giving to us in this section of Scripture. So I hate to bring it to you, or hate to break it to you anyways, sorry, but we're still talking about betrayal this week, which is nobody's favorite topic, is it? I think it's kind of like the downer topic. I'm going to go out on a limb here, and I'm going to guess that everyone in this room, in one form or another, is no stranger to betrayal. I would probably guess to about 100%. In some form or another, you've experienced betrayal. We've all been betrayed. We've all been, you can call it stabbed in the back, you can call it lied to, you can call it used. It's happened to every one of us, has it not? And here's the deep, dark underbelly of betrayal. We've probably all done it to one extent or another. Maybe not in some great, huge way, but probably so, at least once in our life. But in the very least, we've also been on the other side of this. We've all betrayed in some form or another. We've all lied. We've all used people. We've stabbed somebody in the back. Here's the scary part, too. Do we not end up sometime betraying people in spite of our good intentions? I mean, that's what's truly scary to me when I think about it. I think of the number of times in my life where I have ended up hurting someone, and I started out, had no intention of doing that whatsoever. I did not want to do it at all. But because I'm a sinful man, I still did. And I think that's probably the scariest part about betrayal, is what we truly are capable of as people. So whenever we're betrayed, what do we want to happen? When somebody betrays us and they lie to us, they use us, they betray us, they stab us in the back, what do we want? Somebody give me an answer. Let's make this participatory. What do we want? We want justice. Revenge is probably a more accurate word. But that was a better word than mine. We want revenge, right? We want somebody to pay. We get betrayed, we want somebody to pay. When we're on the other side of that, though, when we're on the other side of betrayal, what do we want? Anybody? Forgiveness. We want grace. So it's really, we have that self-centered perspective of betrayal. When we get betrayed, we want blood. But when we're the ones that betray, it was just a mistake. Right? So here's the really cool thing about these passages here and what we're hopefully going to come away with today. We're going to see the betrayal, no matter what form that it is, no matter whether it's betrayal toward God or betrayal toward our fellow man, it does not exist outside of God's providence. It does not, that means it does not exist outside of his control. And we're also going to get another chance to see his response to betrayal, which is not consistent with ours usually. So here's what's going on. Jesus, he's marched down out of the Mount of Olives, which is where the Garden of Gethsemane is. It's on that hillside. I say this because thankfully I've seen it now, which is amazing. I highly recommend traveling to Israel. But I've seen it now. JT and I walked this path. We basically went down the Mount of Olives. We visited what they believe would probably be the Garden of Gethsemane. Basically, there's these olive trees kind of all over the hillside there. So at some point in there was where Jesus was at. You don't know the exact tree or anything, and it's not the same tree, obviously, now. They don't live quite that long, although they do live about 800 to 900 years, I found out, which is pretty amazing. But basically, he was apprehended by this big, angry mob of people led by Judas that identified Jesus. They go down the Mount of Olives. It's a pretty good walk down the Mount of Olives. They come down through what's called the Kidron Valley. So you got basically two big mountains next to each other. They go down into the valley, and they go up, and they kind of would veer off to the left because the Temple Mount is right there facing the Mount of Olives. And if you've seen pictures, JT has preached on this a couple of different times, the Temple Mount is massive. It's huge. It's about 30-foot walls. And when you get close to it and you're walking up there and it's kind of on your right, kind of retracing these steps of where Jesus went, the temple picks up right here and there's the corner of it and it runs down there about as far as you can see. It's massive. And we're talking huge walls. It makes you feel pretty small. But Jesus would have kind of veered off to the left and walked up. But they've actually found these first century AD stairs, Roman, basically Roman staircase. They've uncovered it, they've excavated it, and they believe that's the road that Jesus walked up there. Because the house of Caiaphas, the high priest, where they're going, it would have been situated right here off to the side because it needed to have a direct line view of the temple. So they're pretty sure that in this area, that's where Jesus came up. Pretty interesting stuff. So basically, this is nighttime, remember, if you talk from whenever JT taught us about what happened with Judas. This is in the middle of the night. They came and got Jesus in the middle of the night. Why? Because they were afraid of his influence over the people. They were afraid of him. And so they came and got him at night, and they're marching him up here. He's walking up the hill, and basically he is officially taken into the Jewish legal system at this point. So we're going to read Mark 14, 53 through 65, if you want to pull that up there real quick, either in your old school Bibles or your phones. We're going to read through this section, and then we're going to walk through it. This is Jesus before the council. And they led Jesus to the high priest, and all the chief priests and the elders and the scribes came together, and Peter had followed him at a distance, right into the courtyard of the high priest, and he was sitting with the guards and warming himself at the fire. Now the chief priests and the whole council were seeking testimony against Jesus to put him to death, but they found none. For many bore false witness against him, but their testimony did not agree. And some stood up and bore false witness against him, saying, "We heard him say, 'I will destroy this temple that is made with hands, and in 3 days I will build another, not made with hands.'" Even about this, their testimony did not agree. And the high priest stood up in the midst and asked Jesus, "Have you no answer to make? What is it that these men testify against you?" But he remained silent and made no answer. Again, the high priest asked him, "Are you the Christ, the Son of the Blessed?" And Jesus said to him, "I am. And you will see the Son of Man seated at the right hand of power and coming with the clouds of heaven." And the high priest tore his garments and said, "What further witness do we need? You have heard his blasphemy. What is your decision?" And they all condemned him as deserving death. And some began to spit on him and to cover his face and to strike him, saying to him, "Prophesy." And the guards received him with blows. So that is the picture. That's what's going to happen. That's what Jesus is facing as he's walking up here. I want to give you some background before we walk through this trial, something to kind of measure the trial that Jesus underwent against what it should have looked like legally in that time. The Sanhedrin, the ruling court, they provided legal governance for the community. If you had an issue, you took it to them and they decided it for you. This was like the Supreme Court in Jerusalem. Any village in Israel, any town in Israel, could have a religious council. They only needed 120 men in a village, and they could have their own. But this is the big one. This is it. This is like the Supreme Court in Jerusalem. Had 71 members. They had to have an odd number so they could break a tie because they voted. They had 70 plus the high priest. He was one, 71. And the high priest presided over the council. He was the largest picture of authority in that room. So now, based on the stipulations given to them in the Old Testament, this is all—it's all biblically based. It's in the Old Testament. Here's a few things to keep in mind. about what these trials were supposed to look like. A public trial held in daylight hours. For a capital offense, which they were seeking to kill Jesus, they were seeking a capital offense, a nighttime trial was forbidden. Why? Because we all know bad things happen at night under the cover of darkness. Now, the accused was to be given an adequate opportunity to make a defense. They were supposed to be able to defend themselves. They were supposed to have representation to defend themselves. Any charge was to be rejected unless it was supported by the testimony of at least two witnesses. So if you couldn't get two witnesses, that accused person, if they both couldn't agree, the charge was to be thrown out. It was not seen as to be valid. The Sanhedrin, the religious council, were not allowed to initiate charges. They were there to render a verdict. They were not there to participate and guide. Last one. In capital cases, Jewish law mandated that a full day must pass between the announcement of the guilty verdict and the carrying out of the death sentence. During that intervening time period, the members of the court were required to fast, taking time to reflect soberly on the verdict they had delivered. Consequently, trials were not conducted on the day before a feast when fasting was not permitted. Guess what that night is? The day before a feast. So, needless to say, we're going to see that they weren't really concerned with justice. They weren't concerned with truth. They were concerned with their agenda. We're going to see a complete travesty of justice when it comes to a trial. But really, in all honesty, I realized this. I actually went back and I read Mark from 1 to 14 several times because I wanted to get the full picture leading up to this, the full context of Mark. And you see that pretty much from the moment that Jesus encountered the Sanhedrin, the Jewish religious authorities, the Pharisees and the Sadducees, we've called them many times, from day one, they battled. They were at it. Jesus was healing people. He was healing diseases and deformities. He was casting out demons. And he was hanging out with sinners. And they were saying, Jesus, you're not supposed to hang out with those people. You're not supposed to be kind to them. You're not supposed to love them. And you're not allowed to heal people that way. You got it? That was their very first response. The first time they come on the scene, that's what happens. By chapter 3, that's in chapter 2, the first time they come on. Jesus just launches his ministry in chapter 1. Chapter 2, he's at odds. Chapter 3, they have another situation where Jesus healed a man who had a deformed hand. He did it in a way they didn't approve of. And they went out and they conspired with people that were their worst enemies in order to kill him. It says the Pharisees went out and immediately held counsel with the Herodians against him, how to destroy him. They regarded the Herodians as traitors, but they didn't care. They were like, enemy of my enemy is my friend when it came to Jesus. That was their approach to him from the start. So we're going to get into this. Verse 53. Follow along with me. And they led Jesus to the high priest. And all the chief priests and the elders and the scribes came together, and Peter had followed him at a distance, right into the courtyard of the high priest. And he was sitting with the guards and warming himself at the fire. Now the chief priests and the whole council were seeking testimony against Jesus to put him to death, but they found none. So I want to describe this for you. We've walked up the mountain. We got the Temple Mount on the right-hand side. He's going up. He's entering into the palace of the high priest. And this was a large estate. There was a lot of money involved in religion at this point, okay? This was a large estate. It was considered a mansion. Multiple generations of family would live together. And they would live in these large rectangular-shaped houses. And if you look at, we got an opportunity to see the foundations of what the average house size was at that time. It was pretty small. It would have been basically about from that right there to that wall and about this big. And that's what somebody lived in. But these were large rectangular buildings, basically. They were very large. And they were situated like this. They were just kind of stacked around an inner courtyard that was basically a square rectangle shape. And the courtyard was open to the sky. And then you would have these layers of these estates stacked around it. And if one family would live in each one of these. Now you would enter into that courtyard through this arched corridor, basically. There'd be a large corridor where you could walk in. It would be covered, and you'd walk in, and you would walk into the courtyard, and then you would access these homes there from the inside, from the courtyard. And the courtyard was kind of considered common ground for all of these families. So that's what they did. They entered in, this big procession, this big mob of people entered in through the corridor into the courtyard. Peter follows along behind. They come into the courtyard. Like I said, it's multi-storied. There are two or three stories in different sections. they walked Jesus up these stairs to a large, one of these rectangles was just an open room. It was an upper room, this common meeting area kind of thing for the time. And they would enter into this upper room. And we're talking probably about at least 100 to 150 people. These were large rooms, okay? So that's what's going on. They walk Jesus up the stairs to the upper room. Peter is down in the courtyard. He's kind of being incognito, trying to hide. But he wants to be close to Jesus. He wants to see what happens. And Mark tells us that because he wants us to kind of stow that away for later, because he's going to come back to Peter. Verse 55. Now the chief priests and the whole council were seeking testimony against Jesus to put him to death. So they were presenting witnesses. They were seeking testimony. So what you have are these priests going over to people and saying, hey, you're up. You're up. You got it? Go. Get in there. Give me a home run, right? That's what they're doing. They're saying they're seeking testimony. Why do we seek something? Because we want it. If we want something, we seek it. They're seeking testimony. They're pushing and directing this event. They're just trying to make it look right. They're just trying to go through the motions to make it look right. Verse 57. And some stood up and bore false witness against him, saying, we heard him say, I will destroy this temple that is made with hands, and in 3 days I will build another not made with hands. Yet even about this, their testimony did not agree. So witnesses are being presented by the council. And really, to make it look right, they have to agree for the charge to be valid. They have to say the same things, and they probably had them rehearse their lines. And yes, Jesus did say something like this, but he didn't say it the way that they tried to quote it. And they didn't even understand the context of what he was talking about at the time. But the important part is, they didn't get it right. Even about this, they did not agree. And at that point, the whole thing should have been stopped, according to the law. So it's not going the way they want. So what do they do? It's not going the way they want. What do they do? Verse 60, and the high priest stood up in the midst and asked Jesus, have you no answer to make? What is it that these men testify against you? So imagine if you're in court. I'm sure everybody's been in court at one time or another, whether it's for a traffic ticket or whatever. Imagine that you're in court, this place where you really have no authority. You're at the mercy of the court. And imagine the judge stands up and starts questioning you. How would you feel? Probably not very good. It's kind of a bad sign when the judge is questioning you, right? Now, keep this in mind. The high priest, Caiaphas, this is his house. He has more reason, in my opinion, he probably has more reason to hate Jesus than just about anybody does. Remember I told you that at this time there's a lot of money tied up in religion. This is very true. Caiaphas was part of a family of people that ruled the throne, so to speak, of the office of the high priest. Annas, I used to call him Annas until I actually met somebody who was Jewish and they corrected me, Annas. So Annas is his name. That was his father-in-law. That was Caiaphas' father-in-law. And basically Annas was like, he was the guy, he was like the godfather behind all of his sons who subsequently ruled this office of high priest. He had 5 sons, so counting Annas, that was 6 people over a span of, I think it was probably 50 or 60 years, that ruled this seat. And Annas was really the guy in charge. He was like the godfather behind the scenes. He had been removed by Rome for whatever reason, we don't know, but he had been removed and Caiaphas had been placed in there, but Annas was really still a guy. He was really still the man that people respected. But Caiaphas was technically the high priest. He was the one there in the role. Keep in mind that this family, this almost like this crime syndicate family, these 6 people that ruled Jerusalem and the religious order at that time, they controlled the lucrative operation in the temple. Remember, JT's talked about this. At different times of festival and feast, you would have millions of people that would come to this Temple Mount. And they would travel from all over the place. And they came there to present sacrifices, right? To honor the Lord in these feasts. Well, they couldn't travel with all those animals. So what do they have to do? They have to come here and they have to buy these animals. Who do they buy them from? The family of Annas, basically. What money do they use to buy them with? Well, they can't use their money because that money's no good here. You have to have our money. So what do? They exchange money. That's one of those things where, okay, yeah, I know you got $5 there, but I'm only giving you 3.5 because I've got to exchange your money. Right? So think about that to the tune of millions of people exchanging money, selling livestock, which is a means of wealth back then. How rich were these people? Rich. Because they were abusing their power. It wasn't even meant to be theirs, but they were abusing their power. The system in the temple at this time has become so corrupt that whole system In this time period when Jesus was there, it was called the Bazaar of Annas. That's what it was called, the bazaar. This is his stuff. He's the boss. Keep in mind, too, that earlier this week, Jesus had went into that temple and wrecked it. I mean wrecked it. Threw stuff, wrecked it. Got a whip and drove people out of it, wrecked it because of how corrupt it had become. You think Caiaphas didn't like Jesus? I think he hated him. Verse 61, but he remained silent and made no answer. Again, the high priest was questioning him and saying to him, are you the Christ, the Son of the Blessed One? He was saying, are you the Messiah? Are you the Son of God? So originally his questioning doesn't work. First time, Jesus doesn't answer. The second time, Mark doesn't really do a specific job of saying what happened, but he kind of basically put Jesus under oath. He basically said, if you respect this court, you'll respond to me. That's what he did. And so he said, are you the Christ? Are you the Son of the Blessed One? Are you the Son of God? Now, before we talk about Jesus' response, keep in mind, we've been through Mark, right? Of all the times before leading up to this, whenever Jesus would heal someone, he would cast out demons that other people couldn't cast out. He would do these amazing things. He would heal these people. He would restore them, and they would do backflips, and they would be like, you have saved me. You've redeemed me. I'm going to go tell everybody. And he'd be like, uh-uh. Don't say a word. Don't tell anyone. And we talked about, why would you do that? Why would you do that? Well, you would do that if you had a very specific plan and purpose and a very specific timeline with which to accompany it. All of which belonged to God the Father, not to Jesus. Jesus was willing and submitting to the will of the Father. So Jesus not only had to accomplish his road to the cross, he had to accomplish it in the timing of the Father. And so that's what he was mindful of, and that's why he would say, I don't want you to tell anyone yet. I've got many more things to do before I get to this point that I'm at right now. This is initiating the road to the cross officially. I mean, this is it. So everything has been building up to this moment. And Mark, who is really making a case for Jesus being the king that we're looking for, everything's building up to this moment. And also, before we say what he says, remember, Jesus had this habit of speaking with authority. And what they mean by that is, he would just speak, he would just say things, and they would make so much sense, and they would just cut people so deep, because it was just so true. He didn't need to quote all these past people like all the other teachers did. He just spoke the truth, and it impacted people when he did it. So keep these things in mind. Verse 62, this was Jesus' response. And basically what is becoming a mob of people that are out to get him. He's the only person in there on his side. The only actual person in there on his side. God is obviously on his side. But this is his response. And Jesus said, I am. Now that takes some guts. That takes some guts. Because you know in the Old Testament that whenever Moses asked God, whenever I go before the Pharaoh in Egypt, what do I say? What do I say that your name is? Who are you? He said the best way to describe me is I am. I just am. I've always been. And he says, I am. And he says, and you shall see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of power and coming with the clouds of heaven. He's quoting Psalm 110 and Daniel 7, basically, is what he's doing. And he looks them in the eye and he says, with your own eyes, you will see the Messiah sitting at the right hand of power, at the right hand of God. And then he says, this gets even better. You think that wouldn't make him do backflips? This gets even better. Then he says, and in the end, I will be riding the clouds down from heaven as I come to judge you. Because I'm going to judge the whole earth for their sins. I am that guy. You asked, you got it. Both barrels. Now here's the thing. I really think that for him to stand up there in that moment and say that, that what would have been a very unruly and descending kind of craziness situation there, I really think that he got people's attention. I think they went quiet. I think he put the room on pause with that statement. I really do. I don't have any way to know, but I think Jesus paused the room. I think that was pretty sobering to stand there and say that like he did in that moment, to be that convicted of it being true. So what happens? Well, Caiaphas, in his denial, in his very intense hatred and denial of Jesus, redirects the room. Verse 63, tearing his clothes, the high priest said, "What further need do we have of witnesses? It's just a court proceeding. Why do we need witnesses? You have heard the blasphemy. How does it seem to you?" So this is this situation, what he does, this is all the bad acting of a daytime soap opera, right? He tears his clothes. This is like a sign of grief and indignation that God's name has been blasphemed. And he's basically like, "Oh, I can't believe that you just said that." That's like an equivalent for us. And he's like, "Got somebody behind me, right? Good? Yeah." That's kind of like what he does. He makes this big show of it. Because he wants to redirect the people. He's like, "Oh, that's blasphemy that you just said that. It's not true. It's blasphemy. Make sure that you people understand." Continuing in verse 63, "And they all condemned him to be deserving of death. Some began to spit at him and to blindfold him and to beat him with their fists and to say to him, 'Prophesy.' And the officers received him with slaps in the face." This is yet another time when Jesus shows me up as a man. This first, I'll be honest with you, first thing I thought when I read this, and this is not the end of these kind of things, but basically they're disrespecting Jesus, they're mocking him, they're spitting on him, they're slapping him, they're punching him, and they're saying, "Oh, you've done all these amazing things, why can't you prophesy who's hitting you even?" And my first thought was, this is where Jesus shows me up as a man, because if I was Jesus and I was blindfolded and people were punching me in the face, I would probably stand up, and when they said, "Prophesy who just hit you, Jesus," I would probably say, "Hey, Titanius," or whatever your Roman name is, I had to think of one, "Titanius, touch me again and your hand's going to fall off." Like, that's what I was thinking, right? That's why I'm not Jesus, okay? But now, you think Titanius would have touched him again? Jesus just put a dude's ear back on back in the garden, right? I mean, but he didn't do that. He doesn't do that kind of stuff, right? He just receives it. He just absorbs it, really. You know, there's a prophecy in Isaiah chapter 50, which I would suggest you read, by the way. Isaiah chapter 50 talks about this path to the cross and what it's like. And it says that Jesus did not turn his face away when they spit on him. Now, I'm guessing you guys have never been spit on. If you don't know me, I'm a police officer, like that's and for my career. I've been spit on before, more than once. It's not fun. I can't say that I've ever went like this when people have done it, right? I've never just taken it like that. You always turn away. You don't want that, right? Jesus, he didn't even turn away when they spit on him. And so what happens? The entire room literally descends into this frenzy of pure evil. I mean, it just totally descends into mob mentality. Keep in mind what they're supposed to do when he says, you know, "What is your verdict?" Basically, do we need more witnesses? They're supposed to start with the youngest member of the Sanhedrin first, and he's supposed to raise his hand if he thinks he's guilty. They do the youngest first because they don't want the younger people to be swayed by the older people. And they think the older people aren't going to care. They're going to be honest, right? That's what they're supposed to do. Guilty, not guilty. Instead, the room descends into chaos. They're yelling and screaming, and people start mob assaulting Jesus. That's what this court has become. That's how corrupted it really is. So let's go back and review. What do we know about the Sanhedrin? We know from Mark that up to this point and in this moment, they pretty much as a collective have never been open to the possibility that Jesus was who he said he was. I can't find any indication of it. The closest thing would be Nicodemus, who was a member of the Sanhedrin that came to Jesus at night to have a conversation with him. But some people think he was even possibly doing that to try to chip Jesus up. We don't know. That's the closest thing. They'd never really been open to Jesus being who he was. Here's the problem with that. It was their job to lead people to God. It was their job. That's what they were supposed to do. They never even considered the possibility that he was who he said he was. They gave us a great example, I think, of what it looks like to be outside of Christ, to not believe in Christ, to not follow Christ, and to be there because that's exactly where you want to be. That's where you want to. I want to be here. I want this. I want to be here. I mean, think about it. They had position. They had power. They had wealth. They had influence. And because of that, they refused to give truth even an honest hearing, even to listen, even to be open. Have you ever been in that position? I think I think probably every person in here that is a Christian right now, probably at one point in their life, was rebellious in their heart like this. They weren't a follower of Christ because they didn't want to be. Not because when they heard the gospel, it didn't pierce them like it was true. Not because whenever they really analyzed it with their mind and they considered the possibilities that they didn't think, man, this really does make sense. But because they don't want. I'm going to give you a quote from a guy named Thomas Nagel. He's a present-day atheist philosopher. Just to bring this into our context, he says, and I quote, "I want atheism to be true and am made uneasy by the fact that some of the most intelligent and well-informed people I know are religious believers. It isn't just that I don't believe in God and naturally hope that I'm right in my belief. It's that I hope that there is no God. I don't want there to be a God. I don't want the universe to be like that." Now, what's the problem with that statement? Well, he could be wrong. There could actually be a God. Obviously, I think that there is a God, right? But even from his perspective, speaking truly as an intellectual, which he would pride himself on being, he could be wrong. He could be wrong about that, but he's letting his emotions, his "I don't want," trump everything else. Does that sound like an honest position to operate from? I mean, is it even an honest position to start from? "I don't want." Is that a good reason? If you're here today, and honestly, and I've been there before too, that or something like it is where you're coming from, I would encourage you, consider that. Just take a moment to consider that. Is that an honest position? "I don't want." Let's move on to Peter. Mark takes us to Peter now. Don't forget, the whole time that this is transpiring, there's something else going on down in the courtyard. Peter is trying to stay warm by the fire. We're going to read chapter 14, 66 through 72 now. "And as Peter was below in the courtyard, one of the servant girls of the high priest came, and seeing Peter warming himself, she looked at him and said, 'You also were with the Nazarene Jesus.' But he denied it, saying, 'I neither know nor understand what you mean.' And he went out into the gateway, and the rooster crowed. And the servant girl saw him again to say to the bystanders, 'This man is one of them.' But again he denied it. And after a little while, the bystanders again said to Peter, 'Certainly you are one of them, for you are a Galilean.' But he began to evoke a curse on himself and to swear, 'I do not know this man of whom you speak.' And immediately the rooster crowed a second time, and Peter remembered how Jesus had said to him, 'Before the rooster crows twice, you will deny me three times.' And he broke down and wept." Let's talk about Peter real quick. I think Peter gets a bad rap. And I've begun to realize this more, I think, and JT has mentioned this too, as we've went through this gospel as a whole. I think Peter really honestly has done more to be loyal to Jesus than any of the others, except possibly John. He professed Jesus as the Messiah first. He made statements like, "Lord, you have the words of life." He said, "Lord, you know all things." I mean, he made these statements of faith. He followed Christ, you know, he gave up everything to follow Christ. Really, he gave up his life and just followed Christ around for 3 years. I mean, that says something. Whenever they came after Jesus, he was so angry at Judas's betrayal that he chopped off the ear of one of the servants, one of the soldiers of the temple. You don't chop off somebody's ear because you're trying to hit them in the big toe. You chop off somebody's ear because you're going for the head. And you're probably either a bad aim or they moved, which happens in fighting. It's not clean, right? Chopped off this dude's ear. He was angry. Why? Because he loved Jesus. Now that act alone should have gotten him killed. Why didn't it? Because Jesus healed the man. You know, I mean, it's this mob mentality. Jesus is looking out for his disciples. Peter takes out a sword, chops off a dude's ear. What does Jesus do? Before everything just descends into complete mob rule and they kill every one of the disciples, he's like, it's okay, relax, I got this. I can fix this, right? Just relax, I can fix this. And he did, and somehow Peter managed to get away. He should have died right there. But here he is now, he's in the lion's den, right? He followed this whole mob, this whole procession. He followed them right up into the courtyard. And Peter was a passionate guy. He was a loyal guy. I don't think betrayal is something he would give into easily. But what's wrong with Peter being here in the courtyard right now? In the context of Mark, what's wrong is he was deliberately ignoring the words of Christ himself by doing it. Christ had told him, Jesus had told him, "Simon, Simon, behold, Satan has demanded to sift you like wheat, but I have prayed for you that your strength may not fail. And you, when once you have turned again, strengthen your brothers." He said, Simon, Peter, he said, Satan is going to sift you like wheat. And what you did when you sifted wheat is you shook it violently and you broke the chaff, which is this really light little outer husk, off of it. And then you threw it in the wind. The wheat grain is heavier. It would fall. And then the chaff would fly further away and fall. They would push the chaff away and they would burn it up. It was useless. And Jesus said, Satan has demanded to sift you like wheat, but have no fear. I have prayed for you that your strength may not fail. And in the end, after you have returned to me, strengthen your brothers. That was the word that Jesus had given Peter. And he went on and said to all the disciples, they're going to strike the shepherd, they're going to strike me, and the sheep will flee. And what did Peter say? He stood up and said, they might all flee you, Lord, but I won't. I won't. I'll die for you. And then Jesus said to him, before the rooster crows twice, you will deny me three times this very night. He had very plainly told Peter. But what did Peter do? He said, well, I know in the last 3 years you've done all these miraculous things. You've said this. You've spoken with this authority. You've predicted the future. You got all that other stuff right, Lord, but this, you got it wrong. I got this. That's pretty much what Peter did. He said, I got this, Lord. I know what you're saying. I get it, but you don't understand me. I got this. Anybody in the room ever done that? I have. I know what your word says about this, about fleeing temptation. I know what it says about relationships, about forgiveness. I know what your word teaches me, but I got this. I got this. That is the situation that's going on with Peter. Let's read through this, verse 66. And as Peter was below in the courtyard, one of the servant girls of the high priest came, and seeing Peter warming himself, she looked at him and said, you also were with the Nazarene Jesus. So he followed because he wanted to know what would happen. He was surprised by this question. He was trying to be incognito. He's trying to warm himself by the fire, cloaked up. I'm just a dude sitting here warming, right? Then he gets called out. Verse 68. But he denied it, saying, I neither know nor understand what you mean. And he went out into the gateway, and the rooster crowed. And Peter doesn't notice it that time. So what happened? They call him out. He's like, I don't even know what you're talking about. I know it's the middle of the night, and there's this gigantic mob of people up there yelling and screaming, but I'm clueless. I have no idea, right? It's kind of ridiculous, but that's human behavior. And so what does he do? He gets up from the fire. He walks over here. He goes down to that corridor, the entryway of that corridor, where he's got kind of like halfway to escape if he needs it. And then he stops. He doesn't leave like he should have. He stops. He stays there. And the servant girl after that saw him again and began to say to the bystanders, this man is one of them. So basically a little time has passed. She looks at Peter again. And remember that Jesus and his disciples had just been in the temple teaching earlier that week, and she's a servant of the high priest, so was she. She probably had seen Peter. So she sees him again. She takes issue with it again, right? She brings it up again. She's like, wait a second, you do know Jesus. So there's no more surprise now. Okay, the first time he was probably surprised by it. No more surprise this time. Here's his chance to man up, regain his courage, take a stand for Jesus, follow him, no matter what that means. Here's his chance. But it says, but again, he denied it. So this time that response was premeditated. He's escalated now. He's like, no. Mm-mm, I don't know that guy. Continuing in verse 70, and after a while, the bystanders again said to Peter, certainly you are one of them, for you are a Galilean. So evidently her statements have garnered some attention. She's got some other people now that are catching on. And they hear people talk and say, oh, I don't know that guy. And they're like, wait a second, that's a northern accent. You're a Galilean. Jesus is a Galilean. You do know Jesus. They call him out on it again. Verse 71, but he began to invoke a curse on himself and to swear, I do not know this man of whom you speak. Now, before you think that Peter's dropping F-bombs, you got to understand the culture. That's not what he's doing. He's cursing and swearing. A curse means you're pronouncing a divine judgment on your own head if you're lying. And to swear means like a solemn pledge of truthfulness. He's saying, if I'm not telling the truth, I'll die. Basically, in like an R vernacular, he's like, God strike me dead if I'm lying about this. which also takes some guts considering the things he had just seen Jesus do for the last 3 years. I don't know how I could have said that. I'd have been a little scared, like lightning would have came down out of the sky and just like that, I'm done. I'd have been scared to say that. Peter, in the moment, though, being Mr. Passionate, I don't think things through Peter. What does he say? He says it. So what began as a knee-jerk reaction had escalated into a completely premeditated tirade of deceit and disloyalty, coupled and punctuated with cursing and swearing divine judgments on him, on himself. So I don't know much else about this situation. There's lots of speculation about what led Peter up to doing this and the fact that he thought Jesus was going to rule as Messiah and he wasn't. He was confused. I don't know about all that. But one thing I do know is that Peter's self-confidence and his refusal to heed the direction of Christ put himself in a position he wasn't ready for. That I do know. And because of that, when he was given the option to follow Christ or to cling tightly to this world, to his life that he had right there, he chose this life, he chose this world. And he put himself in that position. And Christ tried to save him from putting himself in that position that he knew he wasn't ready for yet. Verse 72, and immediately the rooster crowed a second time. And Peter remembered how Jesus had said to him, "Before the rooster crows twice, you will deny me three times." And he broke down and wept. So I think with that crowing of the rooster, that second time, Peter was immediately just brought back in. I think all these memories came flooding in, all these things that had been clouding his judgment and his thoughts and this present craziness. I think it all came rushing back in. He broke down and he wept. So Mark gives us these two pictures of betrayal. The Sanhedrin, the religious council, that was a betrayal of Jesus. I know they weren't best buds, but they were supposed to lead the people to God. They were established according to Scripture. That's a betrayal. He gives us these two pictures of betrayal, the Sanhedrin and Peter. And the Sanhedrin, like we said, they kind of show us what it looks like to be outside of Christ and not believe in Christ and to be there because just that's where you want to be. Not because it makes the most sense, not because the truth of Christ doesn't ring true in your heart when you hear it, but because you just don't want to listen. Peter, I think, gives us this example of those who are inside of Christ. They're following Christ, but they still, in many areas, trust themselves more than they trust Christ. We do that. We trust ourselves more than we trust Christ. We want things in our world more than we want the Word of God, more than we want the presence of Christ. We want to listen to other voices more than we want to listen to the voice of Christ and His Word. But I didn't just stop there. As I was reading from 1 to 14, something really struck me that I felt like tied these two things together. I read from chapter 1 to chapter 14, and I began to notice these things that were happening. Jesus wasn't surprised by either one of these betrayals. He knew they were coming. He told His disciples they were coming. He wasn't surprised by it. And so I put them together and I just read them all in one point. I want to do that for you. Starting at verse 9, or chapter 9, verse 31. Don't try to go there because I'm going to go too fast. Just listen to this. Keep in mind that every word that is said here was said by Jesus before it happened. Starting at chapter 9, verse 31. Jesus was teaching His disciples, saying to them, "The Son of Man is going to be delivered into the hands of men, and they will kill Him. And when He is killed, after 3 days, He will rise. See, we are going up to Jerusalem, and the Son of Man will be delivered over to the chief priests and the scribes, and they will condemn Him to death and deliver Him over to the Gentiles and flog Him and kill Him. And after 3 days, He will rise." And when it was evening, He came with the 12. And as they were reclining at table and eating, Jesus said, "Truly I say to you, one of you will betray me, one who is eating with me." They began to be sorrowful and to say to Him one after another, "Is it I?" He said to them, "It is one of the 12, one who is dipping bread into the dish with me. For the Son of Man goes as it is written of Him." And Jesus said to them, "You will all fall away, for it is written, 'I will strike the shepherd, and the sheep will be scattered.' But after I am raised up, I will go before you to Galilee." Peter said to Him, "Even they all fall away, I will not." And Jesus said to him, "Truly I tell you, this very night, before the rooster crows twice, you will deny me three times." But He said emphatically, "If I must die with you, I will not deny you." And they all said the same. Guys, Jesus said all of that before any of that stuff happened. We just read what Jesus plainly told them would happen. Every bit of it. He knew it was all going to happen. he went anyway. God, the Trinity, because Jesus is there, he is present in that moment. Jesus is there doing the will of the Father by the power of the Spirit. God himself enters into that moment willingly. And because Jesus is there, he actually takes the punishment for it physically as a human. So I think there's two things to take comfort from as we consider what these pictures of betrayal are. Number one, God is sovereign over our betrayals. I thank him that he is. He's sovereign over our betrayals, but he's also willingly present in them to redeem us out of them. What do we think when we're in these situations of betrayal, when we're in these dark places? We think God is far away from us. He's not far away from us. He's right there waiting for us to stop saying, I don't want, to stop saying, I got it. He's right there. And because he is right there, your betrayal and mine don't have the power to separate us from him. And that is an amazing truth. I'm going to close with a personal story, something that I encountered that just reminds me so much of this. As I told you, I'm a police officer, and a couple of weeks back, I got called early in the morning over to, there's actually a gigantic homeless camp over kind of northeast of the Glenstone and Kearney Walmart there. And I got called over there by a lady who was wanting to report an act of domestic violence against herself. Her boyfriend had assaulted her. And so I go over there, I'm talking to her, she's come up out of the camp. And this is an older lady, she's rail thin, she's unbelievably dirty. She probably hasn't had a shower in months. And she is very upset because there's been a history of violence. She's taken it and taken it and taken it, and she feels like she's had enough. She's not taking it anymore, and she's upset. And she's telling me over and over again, she's looking down the whole time, and she's just upset. She's walking back and forth, and she keeps saying, I mean, that he had choked her. He had thrown a metal coffee mug at her and hit her wrist and sprained it where it wouldn't bend right. And she keeps saying over and over again, you don't hit what you love. He says he loves me. You don't hit what you love. She kept saying that over and over again, and she was looking down. And I thought, I was sitting there, and I was listening to her. And so I was listening to what she said, and I thought, well, you're right. You don't hit what you love. Why? Because you're valuable. That's why you don't treat people like that, because people are valuable in the sight of God. And so I said to her, I said, you're right. You don't hit what you love. You shouldn't get hit because you're valuable. You shouldn't be treated like that. She's been betrayed by this guy that she loves. I said, no, you are valuable. And you know what she did whenever I said that? She stopped walking. She stopped looking down, and when I said the words to her, you are valuable, she stopped and she looked up to me. She looked up, and she said, she made this leap, which I think says a lot about when we recognize the truth. She made this leap to God immediately like that. When I said, you're valuable, she made this leap. And she said, I know. She said, but I'm far from God. That was her next statement. She said, but I'm far from God. And she started telling me about how she had rejected this lady, this Christian lady that had tried to minister to her over the years, and she had just repeatedly rejected her attempts to pull her out of this life of homelessness. And then she went on to all these relationships in her life, her children and stuff, that she had hurt these people and she had damaged these relationships. And the whole time she's doing it, she's looking down again. She's like, she that little bit of truth that I threw in there, like it brought her up. It restored her, right? But then the shame and the guilt starts piling on of the people. She's betrayed God. She's betrayed all these people that she cares about, and she goes right back down again. And she says, I'm far from God. And I looked at her again, and I said, that's a lie. You're not far from God. That's the beautiful thing about this. You could sit here and you can say to me all the stuff that you've done in your life that you've done wrong, all the people you've hurt, how much you've held your hand in the face of God and screamed at him to get away from you. You can say all that stuff to me all you want. It doesn't matter. You could sit here and tell me about 4,000 good things that you've done in this life, and that doesn't matter. What matters is that Jesus Christ loves you, and he's not far from you. You just have to accept the truth of who he is. That's all that matters. Now, I would like to tell you that at the conclusion of that, she accepted Christ and she walked out of this path of homelessness. And I thought maybe she had for a few days, because I sent her in the right direction. I sent her towards Debbie. I said, "Do you have Debbie's phone number?" "Yeah, I got Debbie's phone number." I sent her that direction. I said, "Okay, call her up, have her come get you." She didn't want to go to a shelter, nothing like that. I said, "Get out of here. You leave this stuff behind." I ran into her, though, last Thursday in the same situation. The truth of that encounter, she encountered the truth, and it breathed this life into her. I watched it twice, just pull her right up out of it. But in the end, she stuck with, I don't want you, God. I want my boyfriend. I want my life. I want my filth. I want my nonsense. All the same things I've said at different times in my life. That's what I want. So I would just encourage you, have the courage that whenever you hear the truth, whenever you know it's the truth, just be open to it. Just be open to it. Don't say, "Lord, I don't want." Why? Just because I don't want. Shouldn't that be enough? No, it's not enough. It's not enough. It's not a good enough reason. I'm just being honest with you. It's not a good enough reason to turn your back on the truth. Don't say to Jesus, "I got this." I just want to encourage you, don't do that. Just repent. Just turn away from that and just ask him. Just say, "Lord, I'm prideful, but I want to be humble. Just help me to be humble." And if that has been you, or if that is you, as we worship, I'll stand in the back. There's many, many people here that you can pray with. Come and talk to us about it. Even if you just want to have a conversation, I just want to know. I just want to be open. I want to encourage you. Have the courage to do that. Don't hide behind your emotions. Don't hide behind, "I don't want." It's not a good enough reason. Let's close in prayer. Lord, I just thank you for this opportunity to stand up here. I thank you for the ability to just have this opportunity to stand up here and preach your word, to hopefully just do so and just in communicating your love and your desire for us, Lord, to just to know you, to be healed, to be restored. And I pray that your truth would just ring through. I pray it would just come through, break through the walls that we have up. Shine your light into our minds. Do not let the God of this world blind the minds of the people in here. I pray against that. I pray that you would just shine your light into our minds, that you would sharpen our hearing, that you would soften our hearts, Lord, because we love you. And I pray that we here that are Christians, we would just communicate that love every single day. Lord, we love you and we thank you. Pray these things in Jesus' name. Amen.